Hello and welcome to episode 120 of the Crate and Crowbar. It's the 24th of November 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and I'm joined today by Toms Senior.
Hello.
And Francis.
Hello.
Hi, Double Toms.
Hi.
Today's news is from 2K rather than 2 Toms. It's not a segue that makes any sense, but we'll go with it. It's not even today's news, it's kind of yesterday's news, but 2K have confirmed, Strauss Zelnick, CEO of 2K, has confirmed while talking to investors that they consider, and I quote, Bioshock to be in the hands of 2K. They'll make announcements in due time about any upcoming releases, but Bioshock is unquestionably a permanent franchise in our company and one that we do believe in. Because franchises are things that companies will into existence with the power of thought, and as long as they keep believing them, they stay around, much like Doctor Who.
I feel like he missed an opportunity for a Bioshock Infinite pun there.
Yeah.
Bioshock is now an infinite franchise.
Bioshock Permanent is the next one.
Seems reasonable that he would seek to reassure shareholders after dismantling the entire studio that made Bioshock Infinite.
Yeah.
And then announcing no future plans for the series.
Did it say something about 2K Marin handling it?
No.
I saw someone quote that, but it might have been a really old bit of news.
Does 2K Marin exist now? Isn't it a very
small
thing?
I don't think
thing?
It does.
Can it runs?
I don't know. I think the name has been, like, the name has applied to two different things in its history, and I don't know if either of them still exist.
Well, I mean, so Irrational's still around. It's not a case of Irrational closing. It's a case of almost everyone at Irrational leaving, and it being our small team with Ken Levine at the center, who are working on something for 2K that will be some kind of narrative emergent thing because it's kind of the in-game. But this is sort of the confirmation that somebody somewhere is working on Bioshock whatever.
The mobile experience.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Bioshock the card battler or something.
Bioshock on the moon.
Yeah, Moonshock. That would just be system. And there's also the System Shock remake, I guess, is happening as well. So just a lot of shocks.
Hmm. They're not like continuing on from System Shock, right? It's
just no, they're remaking the first one, I believe.
Right.
Which is fine. Any particular thoughts on this matter?
It's hard to know what Bioshock is if you take out, because the setting is already sort of, we've established that the setting is not constant.
There's always a man and there's always a lighthouse. That is literally a constant.
That's the franchise, a man and a lighthouse.
Yeah.
But sort of the common thread between Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite is, feels like, you know, that team and those writers and that kind of like, visual imagination. I mean, I guess the best case scenario is a Far Cry 2, Far Cry 1 situation where, you know, someone new comes in and just has a really strong vision of, no, it's going to be this completely different thing. It's going to be open world. And
he's saying they just make Far Cry 2.
Yeah, just actually literally make Far Cry 2.
I was thinking, like, how do you remix those elements? And I was thinking, what about a really big man with a really small lighthouse? But then I realized that's just a torch. Then you have Alan Wake.
What's the one enduring thing about Bioshock, apart from the lighthouse lore stuff? That really
plasmids? Like plasmid equipment?
Superpowers and politics and a city that is where a city shouldn't be.
That's the main one, isn't it?
And masks. That's it, I think.
Hubris and eating apples from bins.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does have... It does have the power to go anywhere. That's probably the most exciting thing about it. Like, the Columbia was amazing, even if people didn't like it.
But they've done two of the three places. Because the three places are the sea, the air, and the land. And a land city is just like a regular city.
They said it was impossible. But we've done it.
Coventry.
Bioshock Coventry. Okay, they could go back to space, I suppose.
That's the fourth place, yeah.
Actually, I saw an amazing... bit of art recently that was, I don't know what it was, I guess just like a bit of surrealist art where it's it's an aircraft carrier, but it's on caterpillar tracks in the desert, and the aircraft carrier is full of water, and all the planes on it are seaplanes. That should be the next Bioshock. Just set it there.
This wasn't impossible. It just didn't make
just
any sense.
Yeah. Well, a city set in time. That's Bioshock. Chronogasm.
Well, they kind of...
They
kind of
did that.
Infinite did have this
did,
time...
Actually, yeah.
They weren't technically time rifts, or they kind of were, but they were sort of parallel dimensions, and so it was hard to say what time they were in. But yeah, they've sort of done, like, that little tear that opened to, like, 60s Paris with an alternate Star Wars showing in the cinema, which actually is in the game, but just in the briefest possible way, and then nothing like that ever happens ever again.
Yeah, maybe the New York bit has a little bit of that.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe what about a city where the people are buildings and the buildings are people?
Yeah, I think we clearly don't have any...
A little fire station living in a man's eye.
It's going to be infinite. We have no idea where it'll go next.
No, I don't know. All these ideas are terrible. Speaking of permanent franchises, Tom, senior.
Got endless franchises. Yeah.
Franchises that simply can't die.
No.
You've been playing, finally arrived on PC, Assassin's Creed Syndicate.
I have. It's this one is set in London, and you play as two people, the Fry twins, who are on a quest to loosen the grip of the Templars over our great capital city. And I've played it for 7 hours, and I feel nothing. I felt nothing playing it and feel nothing now. So it's kind of interesting to find out, like, what I really want to say about it, because it's so templated now.
Templatated.
I was thinking, is there a templat?
So templated now.
That's one of those puns that if you try and write it in the magazine, you realize it doesn't work. There's no way.
That's the magic of live podcasting.
Yeah.
Not live, but just can't be bothered to edit it podcasting.
Yeah.
It's disappointing, and it's I have similar kind of qualms with Fallout in a way, which is more unfair with Fallout, because Fallout's a much better game, but that feeling of just having played it before so many times and just being kind of done with it in a way that I feel really sad about Assassin's Creed, because I've got quite a soft spot for the series and really really enjoyed, like, 2 Brotherhood and Black Flag. I had a fantastic time with them. Loved.
They'll really sort of drain your appetite for that thing, because I also, you know, like that thing. I wanted to play that thing, and that appetite to play it has just been sort of like had an endless assault on it by both good games and bad, and like both those things diminish my appetite to play more. Really, like I've had the good games, and then I've also had bad games that make me, you know, drain my will.
I think there is a team of writers somewhere in the, like, 1,000 strong Assassin's Creed development team that are good at being funny, and they seem to do every other game or something. This is a funny one. This is the sort of good banter between the brother and the sister at the center of it. You meet, like, Darwin and Dickens. You've got to Dickens really quickly after,
is it true that he drops all of his pages?
Yes, and then he drops them all over the city. It's a cutscene where you just bump into them on the pavement.
How spectacularly does he drop them?
It's an extremely quiet drop. You don't even see it happen, but man, like, when the camera turns away, they must have just, like, exploded.
Now they're literally everywhere in London.
Yeah. He's just standing in front of a leaf blower.
And, he gives you some busy work. And you get the classic thing of just meeting celebrities from the period, which is always really fun.
Does Darwin hire you to gas some people?
No, he just, he happens to be on a, you're hired to gas some people, and you meet him also kind of trying to do the same thing.
What, why is he trying?
And then he's there too, also gassing him.
You form a collaborative relationship.
Naturally select this.
The quest is called Unnatural Selection.
It is.
Of course it is.
And, so there's some dodgy medicine going out into London, and you're tracking down the origins of it, which are these giant poison vats in the middle of the city. And, he's there for some reason, like, knocking on the door. And then he goes in and says, "This is the horrible poison. Burn it all down." And then a sub-objective pops up and says, "Get extra points for gassing everyone in the building." It's very surreal in that way. And kind of dumb.
Do all the historical figures explain who they are to you when you meet them in the way of Assassin's Creed of old?
They leave it a few sentences.
Okay.
And they give you a little bit of guessing time. Just like half a conversation worth of guessing time is like, this is someone, this is going to be like a prince or something, or Jack the Ripper or someone. And then, the guy will lean forward and like put his hand out, shake your hand, and he'll say, "Hi, I'm Charles Darwin." And then Charles Darwin will flash up across the screen.
"Did you notice?"
And then like he gets lifted away by like a fucking macaws. I lose my animal powers for good.
Gas bombs.
I do love it, actually. It's such a silly way to use actual historical figures in a way that's almost disrespectful, but I think it's actually too much fun to not go with.
Well, like Leonardo da Vinci basically being Q from James Bond in 2 is brilliant. Like,
makes sense.
That was perfect.
Yeah, so it's really camp, really, really good fun. I think the problem with this one for me is the city, which is sad because it's London, and I was expecting and hoping to be excited by it. But there's something quite strange about it. It's almost as though they've reused the exact same lighting conditions that they had for Unity in Paris. So there is always this kind of reddish sunset going on, and you see these belching towers everywhere in these huge industrial districts, just like vomiting this dark filth into the sky. But the sky is always completely blue. And there were early kind of concept art showing it as this dingy kind of almost monstrous thing that you imagine London from that period looking more like. And this is something strangely pristine about it that doesn't really quite make sense. And that's coupled with the fact that it's full of huge wide streets. So you spend a lot of your time just kind of in carriages. It's like Grand Theft Auto, but with, you know, horse-drawn carriages, and just kind of running down empty-ish streets. And there's something about the construction of it and the fact that the city is just did have boulevards and bigger kind of wider streets that makes it less interesting to navigate for a lot of it. Though you do get a zip line now, which is nice. So you can Batman your way around with it.
Yeah, does that... When I saw that in the first videos that I showed it in, it seemed like that would sort of undermine the free running, climbing thing that's been the core of the game.
It's basically necessary because buildings are so far apart.
Right.
So that these there attempts to kind of, I think, make traversal quicker and allow for wider streets and things. And there also, it also lets them do a lot of structures where they don't have to put contrived handholds all the way up them. So, Nelson's Column is, of course, a point that you have to climb in order to synchronize.
And I imagine that's a difficult one to climb.
So instead of putting like really contrived lumps on it, they give you this thing that lets you just zip right up there and you hang off Nelson's face for a bit, and then you take loads of screenshots and then think about tweeting about it and then don't, because you have funny to say.
It's very specific.
So you felt something. You felt tweet on me.
Tweet on me was as much as I could get out of it, really. I found like one of the... lions at the base of Nelson's Column. They've put a level design, just put a little cat inside the giant paws. I thought that was nice. That's a cute little nod from a level designer somewhere who's just doing a little gag.
Put a cat here.
Yeah, just put a cat next to the cat. And that's the only thing I've been excited.
So that's the other feeling you've had. There's a cat there. That feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, I've not really managed to get much out of it so far. I don't know why I played it for so long. They have tried to revamp the combat and stuff. But it's kind of... It's one of those combat systems where everyone is really, really spongy and tough, and you're hitting them really fast for a long time. And then eventually they'll kind of sink down into a combat ennui state. And that's at that point you can execute them with one blow. And there's a mini game where
I'm as tired of this as you are.
If you get everyone around you into the same ennui state, then you trigger like a very flashy and gruesome kind of combo takedown.
And they're all just tired and sad by that point.
That's right. You just hit them until they're sad.
Multiple ennui kill.
Hit them until they're sad and then brutalize them. Maybe I'll come back with some more developed thoughts on it, really.
But I mean, to be honest, if you've played 8 hours of something and haven't felt anything, that's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
You don't hate it. You don't like it.
There's, like in Unity, there was stuff I really liked about it. So the assassinations themselves were these really like dramatic events, nice sandbox kind of levels they gave you. Lots of ways in, lots of ways of doing things. And nothing feels anywhere near as dramatic in the Syndicate so far after 8 hours of just doing little tiny missions for people. Maybe I should just stop playing it for 5 years. Because it will be there when I get back. Like, it will be there whenever I choose to return to it.
It's an eternal franchise. Permanent franchise?
Permanent Creed. What have you been playing, Tom? Something better, I hope.
I've been playing Invisible Ink, which just got a DLC expansion type thing called Contingency Plan. So Invisible Ink is the turn-based stealth game in the vein of XCOM, but with hiding instead of shooting. I'm always really interested in people's complaints about Invisible Ink because I absolutely loved it when it came out. And actually I loved it quite a long time before that because it was in the IGF. I played sort of several campaigns of it in the IGF, and then when it came out, I played it through at least once more. I think I might have done like an easy run and experienced run. And the campaign is you choose your missions from the global map at every stage, and each one takes you sort of like 6 to 12 hours to fly there, and you have, I think it was 72 hours in the main game before the final mission happens. And so you just do as many missions as you can fit into that time, getting the assets you want. And each mission takes about an hour, and you end up doing about 7 or 8 of them. And so it's about 7 or 8 hour campaign, which to me seemed good. But apparently one of the complaints was that it was too short. And I've read a bunch of them. For some reason, I've looked at just the negative reviews of Invisible Ink on Steam. This is a thing I do sometimes. It's like a game I really like. I just look like, what are the people who don't like this think?
You're just looking for somebody to fight, or?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, isn't there someone who's wrong on the internet somewhere?
You're there just like typing fight me IRL and all.
I never reply to them, but I'm just curious about like what the problem is. It has a really like 93% positive rating on Steam, so it's a great rating. There's no reason to sort of, think what's all the backlash about, because there isn't one. But apparently the people who didn't like it thought it was way too short. And I think it struck a sort of awkward balance, or an awkward sort of mix of roguelike and campaign-like, because Spelunky is 30 minutes long. That's how long it takes you to complete Spelunky. It takes you an hour if you do the super secret ultra hell mega ending, or a bit less. But it takes you a lot of attempts to get good enough to do that, and that's the game. And that's not quite the same as Invisible Ink, but it's still, when I finished it, I certainly didn't think, well, I'm done with that game now. It was, you know, oh, that was an interesting one. I wonder what will happen next time. In fact, I think I did just immediately start a new game. And to me, it was just natural that, you know, that's the game. It's a roguelike. You play it through multiple times and explore it. But it is also story-driven. I think that's where they've invited some criticism that they wouldn't have otherwise got, because it has a plot that not only develops as you go along, but there's a twist at the end. And the twist undermines what you've been doing, which is a very weird decision for a game that's designed to be replayable. You know, they're very open about that. It's a thing that you replay. And yet, the thing that happens at the end makes it seem like half the stuff you did was pointless. And so I think that story element makes people feel like it was designed as a once-through experience. And then if it is a once-through experience, it's still not short, but it's, you know, I guess.
And it's also
you
great.
You might complete it in 6 hours. And the expansion, the DLC, adds... It's weird because, like, there's almost... It's hard for them to really add content that... because it's a randomly generated game, so the levels are already infinite. And the characters you play as, they've added 4 of those. But those are... I already had more of those than I could play. Like, I hadn't unlocked 2 of them, and a lot of the ones I had unlocked I'd never played as, because the starting 2 are just very effective. They're special abilities are just super useful. One of them can move really far and cloak, and the other one can sense devices through walls and also steal power from things through walls, which is amazingly useful. And every time I play as anyone other than those two, it's interesting and it changes your playstyle, but it's always like, what would it be like if I stopped playing the effective way and tried a different way? People really disagree on that. Loads of people think that some of the other characters are, you know, overpowered and stuff, but I've always found the first 2 to be the most effective, so I haven't really explored all the characters I already had, so the fact that they were selling new ones, I was excited because it was new Invisible Ink. But the truth is, there's 4 of them, and one of them doesn't have a taser, so I'm just never going to play as him. He's got like a gun that has a cooldown thing that's really long, and he has a really interesting other gadget, which is like a teleporter, but it doesn't have a taser, so you're just kind of fucked. You only get 2 agents. One of them can't tase people. That's not like a sort of interesting alternate strategy. I haven't played as him, so I shouldn't judge, but like it doesn't appeal to me because the whole game is tasing people. It's standing by the side of the door and then tasing the guy. Then there's one whose special ability is all about killing people, and so if you don't want to kill people, you're not going to play as him, and I kind of don't. I'll probably try him one day, but it's sort of, again, it's a very alternate esoteric playstyle that you wouldn't normally want to do. Then third one has a special ability that's like her only thing special is if she sprints, she gets a bit more KO damage, which is just, I played as her and it was fine. Well, we died. But other than that, it was fine. I just kept forgetting to use it. It wasn't that interesting. And the fourth one is, Olivia Gladstone at age 50.
What?
Olivia Gladstone is already a character at age 68, but, you can play as a previous version of her, at age 50 in this DLC. Which is weird, but her ability is when she tases someone, she refuels your hacking ability, which is actually really useful, and she's very cool.
So why is she there? Because
It's also confusing because she's the person talking in your earpiece.
Yeah. Yeah. But so is there a time travel element, or do they just suspend disbelief?
They call them archive builds, and there are archive builds available for the other characters, but I never unlocked them. And I don't know, I don't think with the other ones that it changes their appearance or anything. I think it's more like just, I don't know, actually, for one of the other characters, at least, it does change their appearance. But anyway, there's two versions of her, and the older one, sorry, the younger one, that has just been added, is way better and has, you know, her abilities are really cool. So I'm playing as her and Sharp, which is not a new character, but a character that I'd only just unlocked in my failed run with the two new characters. And he is a so they're all cyborgs, but, instead of having two slots for cybernetic implants, he has six. And every three implants he installs, he gets more knockout damage. So he knocks people out for longer, which is awesome. And he's really interesting because right from the start, he has basically no abilities. There's nothing special about him at all until he gets three orgs. He's no different to just a basic character with no abilities, but he's going to be your best character for sure because the orgs are amazing. And in particular, like the best ones are absurdly good and they combine in amazing ways. And, I've just got him up to six orgs now. And so he has one that gives him armor piercing on his melee attacks, one that gives him three extra AP, one that gives him two extra AP every time someone wakes up. AP is action points, so it's how far you can move and what stuff you can do in one turn. One that reduces the cooldowns on all his items, and I guess two more, and they're just like, they're super useful things. Like, reducing cooldown on all items is incredible, because that means your taser, you can use it every two turns instead of three. Every like hacking device, every super powerful item has a cooldown, all of those are reduced by one. And so it's like, it's almost like Invisible Blink introduced the idea of always had, I guess, because this goes in at launch, but it's opened up the idea of a hard carry in MOBA terms, like someone who's just going to be, eventually this guy's going to do everything for us. And so until then, we just got to give him all the cool stuff and make sure he levels up. And I've just got to that point now, and that's fucking awesome. But the other thing they did is, I'm now 5 days into my campaign, and so the campaign is now a week long instead of, I'm pretty sure it was only 3 days before. And they've added a sort of middle bit to it. The way they phrased it, I think they undersold it really, because they just said, we've added a sort of a complication in the middle of the campaign to lengthen it a bit. What they really did was just double the campaign length by adding a whole first campaign and then a second campaign, basically.
Does it start where they... the one stops.
Yeah, so technically it is all one long campaign, but the thing where you spend 3 days building towards a final mission, that's now the new mission, a new final mission. And after that point, not only does the game carry on for another, 4 days, and you are at the point that you would have been at the end of a previous campaign. So your people are super powered up and all the enemies are already powered up as well. But they change the way alarms work. So all of the things that every turn the alarm counter goes up, and when it goes up to the next stage, like every six turns or something, it does something like raise all firewalls or, make everything harder to hack, or bring one new guard onto the level. And they change all of those so that now your first alarm level adds armor to every guard, and then the next alarm level changes all their patrol routes, and then the next alarm level, I think, adds demons or something. Demons being like nasty hacking programs. They kind of changed the game, and also every mission after that point, you have to collect a power core from somewhere and steal that as well. So you always have two objectives. So you still get to choose what kind of mission it is, whether you want to get to a special shop or get to a cybernetics org thing or get to a vault with some valuable stuff and that kind of thing. All of those missions now have a mandatory extra objective of getting this special, basically like a safe with a sort of power core in it that you've got to steal to keep yourself going. The idea is that your Incognita is running out of power, and so you need to keep getting her a battery every single mission. So it complicates it in that way as well. And so that's the whole second half of the game, is just this sort of massively amped up version of it. And it's really cool. It's fucking exhausting. I've been playing it for...
Yeah.
I feel like I've been playing it for about 12 hours now, this campaign, and, we're more than halfway through now, but not by much. And my team is getting fucking insane. Like I say, Sharp now has six orgs. I've maxed out, I think two different stats on both of my main characters. And then the ones I've got four people now, because I've rescued two others from detention centers. And we've got three level three cloaking devices, which each of which renders you invisible completely for two turns and, has an 8-turn cooldown. So you can actually use it like twice in the same mission. So with three people with all, with those, I can basically have six human turns of invisibility. And then they all recharge as well. So if it, you have like a recharging device, you can refresh them, or you can just wait. And obviously you've got these torque injectors that reduce cooldowns, and I've got a ridiculous number of buster chips to break through things for free. You can get, have more incognito programs simultaneously. And some of the new ones are quite cool. I'm actually not using any of the new ones now, but I've got this amazing setup where instead of getting a steady stream of power, I get my first program for free. And then I've just got loads of really expensive, really good programs. So I can always get loads of free value each turn. And then I've also got a gadget that you can deploy in the field, and that generates two power per turn, which is twice as good as the normal power generator. And, you know, I'm not even using the normal power generator so that I can have this freebie. Basically, it's just this super efficient system. And I, when I unlocked like the latest tool that I got, which is the thing that just breaks four firewalls at once really cheaply, when I first got to use that on a four firewall thing, I was really excited because it was like, ah, this is going to be twice as efficient as normal. And then I used it and realized, oh shit, that was my first thing of this turn. So it was also free. And the game of like meshing all those things together just keeps on getting more interesting and more satisfying. And it's such like an efficiency nerd's dream.
Is there, so games like XCOM, particularly actually when XCOM gained Enemy Within, this sounds a little bit like in sort of Enemy Within added like a whole substantial extra part to XCOM and added new missions of that and stuff. It had that thing that XCOM has always had that I can't ever decide if it's a good thing or a bad thing, where it gets easier. Like, it's a game that starts out hard and then gets easier.
All right, yeah.
Like, and it's, again, it's that efficiency thing of it's super satisfying later on in an XCOM campaign when you have your mechs and your kind of bioengineered invisible snipers and stuff and nothing can stop you.
Yeah.
Because that's your reward for having suffered through the parts when it was tense and hard. But there's I know in XCOM 2, they're planning to try and address that and make it a more of a difficulty curve as most games, the way around most games are. And so do the new, like, alarm states and stuff make it sufficiently difficult to match your rising power, or is it more like that power fantasy kind of being lived out?
It's very much like a spike. So it's kind of, right now, I am over the spike. And, it's a question of like, when this middle mission happens, it's a two-parter, so you've got to do two missions back-to-back without resupplying or anything. And in the second part, they introduce... I don't know whether it's a spoiler. I guess I won't say it. But it's just... You know how each invisible link mission can be bad in about three different ways. Like, either people can have loads of armor, or there's loads of bots, or there's loads of scanners that keep tracking you.
Or the teleporter's in a really weird place or something.
Yeah, but in terms of, like, the sort of the themes of security you can have...
Oh, right, yeah.
The second mission of these two, you know, has a type of security that there's no way of knowing in advance you're going to get a lot of that type of enemy. And if you don't have the tool to deal with that type of enemy, I think you'd just be fucked. As it happened, I just upgraded that capability of my team, and so I was fine, and we got through it all right. But I really feel like if you just happened to develop that a little bit later, you'd just be fucked on that mission. You'd just be wiped out. So it's quite harsh, and I feel like Invisible Ink has always been that kind of knife edge of there's going to be a difficulty ramp up sort of in the first third of the game, and if you're equipped to deal with that, then after that, yeah, you start to snowball. And I feel like I've got to the point now where my team is just so ridiculously fucking good. We got like an early lucky break, and then that hairy moment where we were really tested and put to its limits, and then after that we just had like another two lucky breaks where things just really clicked together and I got just the items I needed and just the right things to make an amazing team. And so now I am in that snowball mode, but like you say, it's actually really satisfying. I kind of think it's better that way for Invisible Ink, at least, because I've talked before about how it has this amazing failure spectrum. Like, even when you're winning, there's so many sub things that can go wrong in ways that aren't ideal. You're always tense. It's always like, ah, I don't want to get spotted here, or I don't want to run out of power here, or I really need to get that safe. It's always pushing you to kind of do better. And so I'm always worried, and it's always tense.
Oh, that's good.
But I'm not hitting frustrating walls of, like, oh, for fuck's sake, you know, just broken. So I've actually, in between last time I played like a full campaign and this time, I've every now and then I go back to Invisible Ink, I start a new campaign, and I just lose within the first like two or three missions. And partly to just not paying it that much attention, just being cocky because I've been through it once before, and just like hitting a guard with armor before I have any armor piercing. And I, last time that happened, that one guard just killed both of my people just outright. It was just no recovery, no like way to come back from it. And that isn't that much fun. When that's happening, there are ways to avoid it. You can be sort of ultra careful, but it's really just stuff like when it tells you it's this company that runs the level you're choosing, you need to check on the wiki and find out what the different enemies they can have are. And if it's one, if that includes something that you can't deal with, then you need to take a different mission. And so that's not really the good kind of difficulty. The good kind of difficulty is when you, it's all kind of within the game and there's, you know, it's more natural. So I feel like Invisible Ink is at its best when you're basically dominating it.
Yeah.
But you, because it will always do a good job of making you feel like you're at the edge of failure.
I wonder if there's a degree to which this would apply to XCOM as well, where even when you have a game that has a permanent failure state, because even if you're not playing on like an Iron Man mode where you really, it really is like a roguelike, you can still fuck yourself up to the point where it becomes harder and harder or untenable, even on even if you're, you know, if you save at the wrong time or something. I wonder if in a game where the potential time, where there isn't like Spelunky, where at most it's going to last half an hour, you can't have it keep getting harder, because then it becomes a game where you play for 12 hours and then you fail and that's it. Like maybe there's a point where after a certain degree of time investment, the player kind of almost needs a bit of a free ride just to enjoy the power they've accrued, because otherwise people would probably walk away absolutely hating it because they would have the experience of playing 5 days in and then failing.
Yeah. I think that's probably possible in Invisible Ink, but yeah, it tends to sort of push you towards, you just get your shit together. It's a lot of the challenge, or sort of a lot of the thing limiting your capacity to build a great team is not really that you haven't got enough money yet or you haven't played well enough. It's just the shops you've found didn't happen to sell the things you needed, which actually is true of FTL as well. Like it's very much like an opportunity thing. Like if you didn't get the opportunity to buy that, there's just nothing really you could have done. And so that stuff sucks.
Yeah, FTL is an interesting case as well, because I think FTL is actually slightly too long for how easy it is to be completely fucked by the time you get to the end. Like, that's probably my only criticism of that game, because I love that game, but there's that thing where you get to the last boss, and it's the first time you've ever gotten to the last boss, and you've scraped and crawled your entire way to get there, and you're just fucked. Yeah. Like, you're not equipped for that, and basically the first time you do that, you're just told to start again. Very different to Invisible Ink, which is like, okay, you're done now. Well, it was anyway. What's the name of the DLC?
Contingency Plan.
Contingency Plan.
It's good. I think it's like $4 or something. Or Jesus. I think it's cheap. And yeah, I feel like the new characters are not, they weren't a big deal for me, but if you thought the campaign was too short, boy, is it longer now. And it is, you know, majorly different. What have you been playing, Chris?
So I have been playing Star Wars Battlefront, which I appreciate that I spoke about a little bit before, I think, when it was in the beta, and I didn't like it, and I still don't like it. I think it's a profoundly bad game. But and for reasons I don't want to kick it to death, because I think maybe it's been received more generously than I would have expected, but it's not necessarily a surprise that it's not great. Like, it's an immensely shallow thing, terrible value. It's always tricky to know whether to factor that into your assessment of a game, but I think it's the thinnest multiplayer shooter they could possibly make and get away with. Like, I can't really think of any ways it could be less substantial. I mean, maybe they'll find one, but it's £50 for four planets, multiplayer only, a couple of handful of like solo and co-op things that are very extremely lightweight.
Is that four planets, like four levels?
Basically four maps. And then those maps are subdivided to create smaller maps for different modes.
Oh, right.
But essentially it's four maps, really. If you're playing the one good mode where all the features are active, it's four maps. And then fifth map if you pre-order, and immediate season pass stuff advertised inside the game, which is like another £50.
Christ.
So it's that thing, and that's immediately just appalling, and the only reason they can get away with it is because of it's Star Wars and it's now. The thing that I didn't actually, I had an edge of my mind, like the right way to describe it. And I was talking to Sam Roberts, editor of PC Gamer, about this today, and he hit on the perfect way of describing this game, which is, I think in a previous age where renting games was more normal, you would call this a rental. Like it is that, it fits that perfectly. It's sort of fun for most of an afternoon and then you should never play it again. For the reasons I think I described, the shooting is really bad. It does look and sound amazing, but, in a very shallow way and actually in a way that makes its small visual problems really, really stand out. Like the animation's quite stiff and, as has ever been the problem in Battlefield, aircraft don't make any sense in those environments and don't have much to do. And there's always problems with it. The reason I want to talk about it, however, is because as I've played the full version and experimented with the modes, the way the fantasy that that game sells, which is all that it sells, like even the reviews that like it, it's like, well, this is a very thin shooter. It's mega mass market. You know, it's not going to win any awards for game design, but oh man, you know, I've never been in Star Wars like this before. I've never climbed inside this. And I've actually always disagreed with that. I actually don't feel like it's very, I mean, I think it's very Star Warsy, but in a very, very specific way. The game presents itself like a museum piece. Like you log in, the main menu is like this kind of beautiful, crisp white background with a very high, and then it'll put a random high quality Star Wars render on the screen and kind of lavish it like a really close up of a TIE fighter or R2-D2's face or something. And the idea is it feels like you've kind of opened the DVD extras or something and you're getting this sort of bonus disc full of high quality archival Star Wars material. And there's this sort of, there's a reverence to it, but there's also a pretentiousness to it. It's sort of, it's like, it's taking nostalgia and then saying, and I love Star Wars. Like Star Wars is the one thing that I think I've been obsessed with in my life multiple occasions more than anything else. And I shook it for a long time. And when the new film is coming back, playing the miniatures game now and that kind of thing. In fact, I was going to say earlier that if I ever need an excuse for why I spend my weekends playing with tiny Star Wars models, I'm using an archival version of my personality, from about 18 years ago when I was 10. You know, it's enormously reverent, but it's a bit pretentious because the way it presents Star Wars is something that's not sort of fun or knockabout, but kind of like pristine and, you know, beautiful and all the rest of this thing. And there are moments where that really works. Like, you know, the sound design is phenomenal and they have got the look of it right in a lot of ways. And like the way AT-ATs explode is good. And there are moments where the atmosphere clicks, but I want to talk about Hero Hunt, which is one of the many optional modes that you have, including like a little CTF variant. And these are universally quite dump because it's a bad shooter. Like the basic level, the guns are crap. So it doesn't, you know, you can certainly do those things and they certainly flesh it out and make it less thin, but it's like, well, you know, it's never going to, as I say, it's never going to win the awards for that stuff. But, Hero Hunt is an interesting idea that they almost certainly definitely shouldn't have done. Because the point of that game is, okay, you're inside Star Wars. Hero Hunt is like an asymmetrical deathmatch mode. All the players are competing against every other player. But it's like the sort of Predator mode that FPS is where one player is superpowered momentarily and the other players have to hunt them. So, and you can do this either way around, but the way I dropped into it was on Endor. So it's a forest map and that actually really enhances the actual movie Predator feel of it. So thick jungle, 8 players, I think, or 10 players. All of the players are rebels on the same team as each other, but one player is one of the Imperial heroes. So either Darth Vader, Boba Fett, or the Emperor. And then when that player dies, the player who kills them becomes the next hero on the rota. So if you kill Darth Vader, you become Boba Fett. If you kill Boba Fett, you become the Emperor. If you become the Emperor, you become Darth Vader and so on. And you can only get points as the hero, who's essentially the monster. Okay. And this is kind of fine on paper. There's also like a mode, I think, where the heroes just fight each other. And the intention of this is you get to play the hero, which you might not always do in a regular match because it relies on finding a power up, all this stuff. But it creates the most hilariously broken interaction with that fiction because it still takes itself desperately seriously. When Vader spawns the Imperial March, like Vader's theme kicks in and all of these characters are constantly shouting lines from the films. Like when people go like, oh God, it's so faithful to the movies. Yes, you have like, you just, Vader is just bellowing as he swings his lightsaber around doing Vader things. And the Emperor is particularly bad for it because the Emperor just shouldn't fucking be in that game. Like, and you know, somebody said, and I don't want to call people out, but like somebody said like, you know, oh, isn't it wonderful? There's nothing of the prequels in this game. Fuck that. The Emperor literally fucking flies around. Andy Kelly pointed out that he has like a dash move where he flies and his skirt flies off. his bathrobe. He's an old man in a bathrobe who flies around shooting lightning out of his hands. And he does this like barrel roll that looks exactly like M. Bison's Psycho Crusher from Street Fighter. But that's the problem with the Emperor in total being in the game. So the Emperor will spawn and some Star Wars music will kick in, and then Rebel High Command will say, like, "We've just got word in from our intelligence. Emperor Palpatine is in the field." Like, why is he there? Like, that, you know, Return of the Jedi makes a huge deal out of the moment you see the Emperor for the first time. And, you know, that scene where all the Imperial officers are shitting themselves because the Emperor is actually coming to the Death Star and they're behind schedule because, I don't know, bad project management or something. Like, you know, the Emperor is supposed to be, like, this figure of power, and the game could not undermine him more, right?
My favorite part actually playing this briefly is when someone goes, "The Emperor has been defeated."
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, let's go home then. This thing is done now.
So when the hero characters die, they actually just kneel and then vanish. But what this means is you have a moment where, like, Vader's kneeling and all of the rebels, obviously the person who's becoming Vader is at that point also vanished because they're becoming Boba Fett. But everyone else will just teabag the kneeling Vader for a while. So that's problem A. But the problem B is just like the behavior that this mode encourages is the most unintentionally hilarious fuck up. Because you create these situations, especially on the Endor map, which is all like, it's got a crashed rebel transport and like winding little jungle passageways and stuff, where obviously the player who is playing as the hero character wants to stay the hero character for as long as possible time, needs to rack up kills. You can go on rampages. Like, they are capable of just like mowing into a group of people and wiping them out. Boba Fett's flamethrower or Vader's lightsaber and that kind of thing. But your health bar is hard to replenish. So every little hit you take, even if it doesn't do much damage, is ultimately depleting the time you have. So it's much, much better to play an ambush play style where you hide and then jump out at somebody and then run away. And so it creates situations where the Emperor will be inside a log, up in the trees, like, crouching, but shouting, "Come to the dark side! Feel your negative feelings!" Shouting at these rebels that are below him, trying to throw grenades up into them. And then occasionally, the Emperor will do, like, a Bison Psycho Crusher out of the trees, electrocute one rebel to death, and then flee into the bushes with his little bathrobe, like, flapping in the distance, shouting lines from the films as he goes.
I used to be cool.
Yeah. And all the rebels, because obviously they're all competing with each other to be the first, to be the person to land the killing blow, will hare after him into the bushes. As like the Star Wars music swells up and the authentic blaster fire sounds sourced from ILM's original material kind of fades away in the background. And then you'll lose track of the Emperor and you've got a limited motion tracker. And at this point you're like, you know, prowling through the jungle, like trying to figure out, cause you can only detect the one character if you're the rebels, cause there's only one enemy for you to detect. And you'll be like, is he above me? And then you just look up and you'll see him crouched there, like, use your aggressive feelings. And then he'll like electrocute you and run away again. It's like, this is like, in some ways, maybe the best thing ever, but it's so wrong that it's like, it's the most fun I've had with the game as well. Like realizing that Boba Fett had managed to use his jetpack to get up into like a big hollowed out part of a tree and was hiding there. And I could just see the little antenna on the top of his helmet poking out at the top of things. And he would just poke up and then shoot a little bit and then hide again as, yeah, we all kind of gather around and try and coax him down from the tree, like firemen. Like it's, I don't know. I don't think there's any way of calling that. Like, I appreciate that it's a side mode and not the main event. The main event has similar problems because the main event has, you know, the Emperor arriving in the middle of a fucking Battle of Endor to run around on the ground, electrocuting people while, you know, Han Solo's absurd. Han Solo, like, arrives in battle and they'll have these moments where they like swagger into battle if you transform into a hero character. And he'll say like, you know, "Things I do for this princess." And like, then like do a cowboy stance. And then you literally just fucking run. They've taken that moment in A New Hope where he like sprints through the Death Star, which is a really great bit of, you know what I mean? That moment basically created Indiana Jones, I think, that as a character. Because he sprints through the Death Star, he turns a corner, he sees a load of stormtroopers and he runs the other way. And the point of that moment isn't that he's a man who runs very fast and has a gun. The point of that moment is that he's kind of reckless and, you know, a bit of a chancer and all the rest of these things. And whereas that translates into a shoulder charge, the ability to fire his blaster very fast and the ability to charge up his blaster to do a single shot, but he kills him basically one headshot anyway, and it's quite easy to land the headshots. So you just charge into just a whole battalion of stormtroopers, just firing wildly and killing everybody, and they then hair off after, because he's the fastest man alive. Like, he's so fucking quick. Like, he's out of the jungle and gone before you see anything. And it creates, like, it's actually quite a scary experience. If you're trying to push on Endor and you can't tell where Han Solo is going to come from, like, you'll just sort of, like, emerge from the bushes and, again, shouting lines from the films or, like, shouting Han Solo-esque things, like, there's nothing lucky about it. Wah-ha! Blah, 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 and then, like, blow up an AT-AT and then just, like, hair off into the jungle again. And the whole thing is so stupid that, I kind of almost, it made me more fond of the game because it's such a spectacular tonal failure. Given that tone is literally all that game has going for it, that, I don't know, I find it quite endearing. Like, just, you fucked it. The moment the Emperor is hiding in the bushes, squawking at people.
That mode is called Hero Mode. Right?
Hero Hunt.
Hero Hunt. If you, all the major characters you can play as in that mode are, Empire ones, doesn't that somewhat contradict the name? Isn't it basically Villain Hunt?
Well, it's because it can go the other way around. You can be a team of stormtroopers hunting a rotating selection of Alliance heroes. When you're in case, it'd be Luke Skywalker, then Han Solo, then Princess Leia, then Luke Skywalker, then Han Solo.
Princess Leia, like, hiding in a log.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's even worse. Like, and Princess Leia's kind of probably, I mean, I assume that's, well, there's a screenshot that suggests, I haven't played it the other way around. But yeah, like, she's designed to be like a buff character because they couldn't really figure out what to do with her. So, like, I feel she like creates shields.
There isn't really a strong link between, like, major characters in the films and people who should be bosses in a video game. Like,
yeah.
Princess Leia is not really a kind of boss character.
She could just put down some really hard legislation with
she can really not tell you where the rebel base is. She can strangle Jabba. She has really, like, plus, she has really strong counter to Jabba. If they draft Jabba, you have to pick Leia.
Oh my god, imagine if like Jabba was DLC or something.
He's just airing around the jungle.
He can't move.
Yes. He's just hiding in the bushes, hiding in logs.
Oh god, like,
it just gives orders to kill them.
Yeah, like, this is the problem. Like, there's a game to be made here, and like, I have a really specific, like, I know people who like Star Wars still like Star Wars in different ways. You know, like, the side effect for me, a really unfortunate side effect of the new film, is it's made me angry about the prequels again. And I got over the prequels about 6 years ago. And I don't think in terms of things that are frivolous, I don't think I've ever been angrier about anything than those films. I loathe them. And I won't hear a good word said about any of them. But, therefore, all those little hints of the prequels in the new one, that, like, they've used some sound effects from episode one, and it's like, I get annoyed. Like, I can't really use the shield effect on the X-Wing because it is from episode one. I'm like, fuck this, crash into a wall. But that's me. But I think there is a really good, so the specific way, like, I think there's a really good Battlefront game to be made by DICE, weirdly, because I think the game they could make would be a lot more like Battlefield. Because one of the things the mistake they've made, ultimately, on the tone of the game, which is supposedly its best feature, is they have done what a lot of bad Star Wars, including the prequels, have done, which is imitate Star Wars rather than imitate the things that Star Wars was imitating. Because Star Wars was imitating mostly World War II films and, you know, and Japanese movies. And, you know, all the dogfighting was straight out of World War II movies.
And samurai films.
Yeah,
and stuff,
like, and all of the actual battle scenes you see in Star Wars, and there's only a few of them, like the Battle of Hoth. And to a degree, the Battle of Endor, but that's complicated by teddy bears. You know, in Hoth, they're not jetpacking around, laying down bubble shields and firing rocket launchers. They're just holed up in trenches. Like, it's, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's supposed to be a landing. It's an Omaha Beach thing. Just the good guys are on the opposite side. And instead of amphibious landing craft, it's these giant walkers that don't make any sense. I think the game you make, if you're not going to make an old school Battlefront where it's all about the sandbox and it's all about the silly powers and where you can have the silly stuff because it is just this big box of toys and you're given loads of different ways to interact with it. If you're going to make a more focused game like this, which is only about a couple of modes and a couple of maps and stuff, I think you have to make a much more, almost like a more quote unquote realistic shooter. Because the reason Battlefield works is the systems are actually quite deep. The guns, you can get into those guns to quite a firm degree of granularity. You can customize your loadouts and stuff. And at its best, you feel like you're in a real war. Ironically, given how indebted Star Wars is to World War II films about World War II, and given that the Battlefield series started off as a World War II shooter, Battlefield 1942 with a Star Wars skin would have been a better Star Wars game than this, I think. In terms of like the how the battles should feel and like the pace of them and the lethality of them and so on.
I think there was a Star Wars mod for 1942.
There almost certainly was, yeah.
Feels like there's been so many constraining factors on Battlefront. The first one being a 2-year development cycle where they have to just come up with these assets. And
yeah.
That's one of the reasons why it's so slim. And the second one is just raw marketing and the sort of game that you can sell to a lot of people who don't normally play games perhaps, but might buy it because Star Wars is out. And that's got to be like one of the main driving ideas behind it.
Yeah.
Though I think like, I can imagine there being a ride in Disneyland like next year, where they just reuse those maps and it's like a virtual reality experience and you strap on a helmet and they charge like however much for each run and you know, you just glide through it. Like it really does have that feeling to it. It's very strange. The one thing I really hate about it is that the guns are rubbish. I just think for DICE, who are so good at guns, oh my goodness, Bad Company and Battlefield 3, those guns felt so good. And maybe it's because it's all lasers, but surely they could have done a better job.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of question, actually, because like the sound effect has got to be the same as the movies and it's got to look the same. But then you still have some leeway in terms of things like recoil and damage and, you can still adjust how it feels.
Yeah, and recoil doesn't really make sense when you're firing a light.
No,
and
but then the light is also travels at a relatively low, slower than a bullet, to ask his head.
Lasers don't make any sense, which is reasonable. But there's also kind of just weird lack of accuracy that's really frustrating as well. I can't stand any of the guns.
although there's like a couple of like one-shot sniper rifles and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That almost break the game. Well, don't break the game. That's maybe too strong. But like they break the fiction of the game because you don't see people sniping in Star Wars, really. Like you don't see people like getting... Everyone dies in one hit, really. Like they take a shot and they fall over, which is hard to do in a game. But there's not a lot of like, you know, camping or sharpshooting. It's all quite hectic. And I think the reason they made the guns inaccurate and low damage is so that there's a lot of fire in the air. Yeah. It's not about these, you know, like double tapping somebody. They want the air to fill with lasers, and I do get that. But they've added in these kind of like, you know, you get one shot sort of like bolt rifles and plasma guns and stuff that are very effective because they break the paradigm of the way the rest of the weapons are designed. But also don't actually really contribute to the atmosphere of the game very much.
Yeah.
Like, I think there might be a more intelligent way of making a game around inaccuracy in that sense. Like, I kind of feel that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make something where you do spray in the direction of enemy. It's not about perfect accuracy, but I don't know what else you put around it then to make that feel good.
Brothers in Arms was a good game about inaccuracy. Like, that was sort
of a World War II game,
the suppression idea.
Yeah.
And like, your people couldn't hit for shit, but they could just lay down fire on an area and that would just keep people behind their sandbags. And then you could, you know, run in and assault them. And
Battlefield 3 and 4 has, well, 3 especially has suppression mechanics, but they're really controversial because if you're on the receiving end, your vision is blurred out.
Right, and multiplayer, it's kind of different, I guess.
Yeah, so it's a tough problem to solve. My favourite moments I've had with Battlefront, which I genuinely dislike, have been with a pistol in close combat, and actually pistols are close combat weapons in this game, whereas it's always shotguns and pistols are just weirdly good at range in video games for some reason.
Yeah, that's true.
But the best moments I've had have been just like rounding a corner with my pistol and in third person just kind of like 2 or 3 shots taking someone down. And that felt really Star Wars, because that's really how people go down in Star Wars. It is just a couple of sparky shots to the chest.
There's a lot of, and especially like with, you know, the iconic use of pistols is Han Solo, who is supposed to run around a corner, fire one shot and then run the other way. I mean, they fucked up the actual Han Solo in that game by making him unstoppable. Like, whereas the point is, he's supposed to come off as stoppable but lucky, which is a really different thing, which you actually feel more like if you have got the pre-order exclusive Han Solo's pistol.
Oh, God.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I guess they're always going to do that, won't they?
It makes me nostalgic for the first Jedi Knight game.
Yeah.
You don't get your lightsaber in that till 5 hours in. And the whole first 5 hours is just you being a Han Solo type character. You have a pistol that's accurate, but, I think you can charge it up, can't you, to do a sort of superpower blast, but it's very low fire rate. It's feels underpowered, but it's accurate, so it's good for precision work. And then when you can take a blaster off anyone you kill and you can use that, but it's just wildly inaccurate. And it's just if you're really close to someone, then yes, you can mow them down. But other than that, it's just a kind of spray weapon. And then I remember using thermal detonators tactically in that game and just getting really into the fantasy of being
I think you get a bowcaster at some point as well, which has got like a three-shot spread, and that's really, really fun.
The thing is, like, I've written a bunch about this because I get asked to talk about Star Wars so much, but the best Star Wars games, things like X-Wing as well, and Dark Knights, Dark Forces series, I think, have done this brilliant thing that actually very few franchise games have done. Like, people never really think of Star Wars as franchise games because the franchise is so big. It can be games and no one thinks of it as a movie tie-in. Battlefront feels like a movie tie-in, even though those movies came out 30 years ago. But the best Star Wars games have actually really contributed to the fan base's collective understanding of how that universe actually functions. Like, there's a lot of interesting examples of really clever game design where people have gone, hang on, we've got some sources from books and comics and the movies, but we need to figure out how to create a game system that puts the player in charge of these devices and weapons and vehicles in a way that makes them feel like real devices, weapons and vehicles, but also creates the same kind of situations that occur in the movies. Because it's always had that obsessive attention to detail. Like, every TIE fighter pilot who's ever appeared on screen in those movies has a name now, right? Like, they've mined the movies for every last thing. The types of loops they do in the dogfights, the way they move, all of that stuff has been translated into given names and all the rest of it. And, but the games did, like, especially the dogfighting games did a brilliant job of, like, explaining the subsystems of an X-Wing in a way that not only makes a good game where you can feel like you're controlling a real spaceship with lots of detailed, you know, systems you can interact with and, you know, things you can learn and finesse you can employ, but also successfully recreates the kinds of things those ships do. Whereas if you compare the same thing to something like Battlefront, where the dogfighting is incredibly light, you know, you just move around, you hold down the right mouse button, you hold left mouse button, it auto-aims for you. Right? They're putting every single training wheel they can possibly fit onto that thing and put it on that thing. There's some strategy, but it really is just fly around and have a nice time to try not to hurt yourself. And as a result, the individual vehicles are differentiated by the fact that, like, X-Wings can shield themselves and TIE fighters can boost, but there's no real feel to them. There's no kind of sense that you're actually in that world because you're really just controlling a cursor, and behind the cursor is a picture of an X-Wing. And there is such a big philosophical difference in game design between that and something like X-Wing Alliance. And I get that it's accessible, but I always find that a bit of a disingenuous argument because Star Wars has always been popular. Star Wars didn't suddenly become popular when it became stupid. In fact, the opposite happened. So, yeah. But I did get to see the Emperor literally leap out of the bushes like a velociraptor and drag a man screaming back into the undergrowth before fleeing, shouting about the dark side.
Shall we do questions?
Yes. All in favour?
Aye.
Excellent. Aye. Martin Lawrence, presumably not the actor, writes...
Amazing if it was.
Amazing, yeah. But it's still great either way.
Chris Rock is a PC Gamer fan.
Is he?
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, really? There's a photo of him holding a copy of PC Gamer that he's just bought.
Well, if you don't like PC Gamer and you touch it, it catches fire. So, so that he must like it. Martin Lawrence writes, "Hi, I'm a grey-haired gamer from Mud Bay at University. Today's modern iOrgies, I've poked, 80s reference there, and choked at vital points, my way through a fair number of them, and there's always more fun to be had with the next one-up. I've had the time of my life playing games, and I'm keen to pass this experience on to my daughter. She's already hooked on Minecraft, which my wife and I have shamelessly used to extort homework out of her in exchange for Minecraft minutes. Being the awesome knowledge gods that you all are, I'm hopeful that you might have some ideas of different sources, as I am anticipating a tolerance being built up. Most of the Flash-based educational offerings are pretty dull. In my daughter's mind, they're akin to extra homework, mathletics, phonics, and spelling. These medicines need more sugar, in my mind. Alternatives don't necessarily need to have educational merit, since the earn-a-minute mechanism is working. They just need to hook her imagination to be suitable for her age. Having said that, if there's a game that teaches a philosophical, economical, political, geographical, temporal, physical, mathematical, or similar concept, I'd be interested. She does like Portal 2, but not the scary bits, and I suspect one of the major components of the enjoyment is our interaction. Multiplayer Minecraft is great for that." And he concludes by also saying, "Tom," meaning Tom Francis, "tell me about your hands. Mine hurt too. Which controller fixes it for you?" We start with the last bit and then work back.
Yeah. I suspect he's responding to me saying that I haven't been able to work for a while because of my finger, which is not actually an RSI thing. I just had an infection. But I do have an answer for that, which is just a normal Xbox 360 controller. I use every opportunity I get to avoid RSI, because mouse and keyboard is what I use for work, and so I don't want to use that for games wherever I could possibly avoid it. So I've actually been playing Fallout 4 with a controller, and it's been fine.
On the topic of games that might suit this, it's obviously kind of tricky to find like something that isn't just like an out-and-out kids game, but I think we were all agreed that Kerbal Space Program is a really potentially good game for this.
Yeah, the Kerbal, through experimentation, teaches physics of the cosmos by letting you build spaceships and launch them into orbit and commit to various space missions. And I think as a collaborative game, it's also excellent if you want to sit down with your kids and build spaceships together and then launch them and they explode and then you try again and gradually learn kind of how this is work. I think that's just it's a good game, I think, for that.
If I haven't played it, but if that proves too complicated, I generational jump going the other way, but I've played a game called Armadillo Run with my dad, and it's a physics puzzle game where an armadillo in a ball drops from a certain location and you need to get into a certain other location, and often it's just like blank space, so you have to place platforms and like they sort of pivot around the hard points in the level, and you can, I think, tie cloth between certain points and attach rocket boosters to things. And so it's a very like physics-y puzzle game where you just got to get a ball from a starting point to an objective. And there are, you know, infinite ways to do it. And it's kind of all about efficiency and how well you can do that. And me and my dad would both try and solve the same level and then like compare notes and show each other different solutions and then realize, oh, actually, if we use that bit from your solution and this bit from my solution, we'll probably get a better one.
Also mentioned City Skylines, which is probably the best modern SimCity game, stuff like that. Like, none of these are games for kids, but they're all able to be played at a low enough level that you can have fun creating things and trying to solve fairly simple management and efficiency problems in a creative way, or just making something you like the look of.
Yeah, you can definitely, City Skylines, you can definitely sort of focus on just making something that's nice and not necessarily trying to min-max anything if that's what you prefer.
Maybe the important thing to point out about Kerbal as well is that even though it's at the high end, it's an incredibly unforgiving, punishing simulation of spaceflight. It's also like relentlessly cartoony and cheery, so that if you just want to build silly rockets and blow them up, like, it doesn't feel like that's out of the, you breaking the game doing that or anything. Yeah. Like, it's perfectly doable.
I'd almost want to, I probably wouldn't recommend Spore actually, but it's almost the sort of game that would be amazing. If I played that when I was 12, I would have been absolutely astonished.
I'd recommend Spore.
Yeah. It's still working though. That's what I'd worry about.
I think so.
Because it had this big kind of interconnectivity, kind of people sharing creatures thing.
Yeah. The Sporepedia, in particular, the main thing you need to do is subscribe to a Sporecast, which is like a list of user-made content that's curated. It's actually totally predated all of Steam's, you know, curated workshop content and stuff like that. And I used to run one for PC Gamer called the PC Gamer Sporecast, which will, you know, if Sporepedia's still up, it will still exist and we'll still have a whole load of great stuff on it, but obviously it hasn't been updated for about 7 years.
If you get your child to play Spore, you have to be really careful what procedure generated data they pull in.
Yeah, so that's the thing. You, that's like the planet by subscribing to a Sporecast, you sort of say, I want everything that's in this one, and I can tell you there are no penises in the PC Gamer Sporecast when I left it. I don't know what's happened to that place since I left. But
you don't need to be, you don't need those to actually play it, do you? You can play
just fire it up, but then you get like the Maxis made creatures and they're terrible.
But I think if I was 12, or I don't know how old,
implying child primary school, maybe late primary school, don't know.
I think that's a good level for Spore actually. Cause okay, we should explain what it is. So Spore is you create your own species of creatures and they live on your planet and they breed and you get to kind of evolve them into, you know, superior forms as they explore and discover other things, and then eventually you can turn them into a spacefaring race and blast off into space and explore space. And but it's a much lighter touch than Kerbal. It's not a simulation in the same way, way.
You design the creature the way you want it to look, and
which is like a penis if you're most people.
that's the highlight of it, really, is building a creature and just being able to like give it as many legs as you want and bolt on three arms to its kneecaps and then give it seven eyes, and then you just click a button and it walks around, and that's the magic of it.
The AI figures a way for that thing to walk, that kind of gross thing you've made, and it really
by its testicles
in some cases. But yeah, I think
legsticles.
You could play it without ever encountering any of that stuff if you just if you don't subscribe to anything, if you just play it.
Yeah, cool. It is probably the greatest danger of crowdsourced dongs, though, of any of the games suggested. you can make things that look quite a bit like a dick in Minecraft. Mm. And you can make things that look quite a bit like a dick in Kerbal Space Program, because that's all rockets.
Yeah, that's true.
But
can't really get away
the danger in both of those instances, they are slightly more abstract, whereas Spore will let you just build a big floppy dick that walks around and then eventually goes to space. But that's no reason not to try it. But just don't do that. John writes, "Hi, Scroats and Craybars, ?" I guess. After hearing you talk about it a few weeks ago, I went back and checked out the Mr. Odd playthrough of Somar on YouTube, which is something that Tom talked about.
Yeah, and I think John's next sort of couple of paragraphs are just saying pretty much what I said at that time, which was that I didn't engage with the game that much, and I was kind of breezing through it, and watching Christopher Odd's playthrough on YouTube was amazing because he super engages with it. He studies every little detail and reads every log, and like he'll look at the date on each log and say, "Oh, this is 3 weeks after the last one," and pieces it all together to a much greater extent than I did.
Yeah, so he goes on to say that it made him realize that after playing 20 years worth of games, I've become blind to environmental storytelling. When it comes to third person or sci-fi horror, especially when it comes to them, I can walk through an airlock into a room with a dismembered corpse and bloody writing on the wall without even realizing that something's amiss. To me, that's just how games look.
Mm.
Bioshock was the turning point for me. The game never seemed to look like a city to my eyes. The kitchens weren't distinct from the ballrooms or the bathrooms. Games like that have just become a series of contextless rooms. Dead bodies are indistinguishable from bins. Except you don't eat candy floss from a dead body. Actually, you do in Bioshock. Both are just containers for apple cores and cigarettes and bullets. Mash E on everything and move on. If I trigger an audio log from an individual's played out on a table, I don't think my mind would necessarily even put together that the log told the story of that person. It was only watching somebody else play a game properly that I realized I've been playing them basically blind to the level designer's intentions. Am I alone in this? I suspect not, right? You've all played a lot of games, and after a certain point, you don't see the code. Don't you see the code behind the matrix? It's all just geometry and triggers. Some of you also play games for a YouTube series. Do you find your level of immersion and comprehension of a scene is increased when playing for an audience? Are there any games that fall into or break out of this mold for you?
Yeah, so I definitely have the same environmental storytelling blindness. I feel like I did notice it a bit in some games. I guess probably noticed like the more esoteric ones, like just sort of tiny little details in Half-Life 2, because I replayed that game like 11 times. But things in Bioshock, I remember listening to an audio log from Souchong in Bioshock, and like only after replaying that section sort of a third time did I realize, oh, like that guy I got that audio log from about Souchong dying, that is Souchong. Like, obviously, because it describes in great detail the circumstance of his death, or like you hear him dying on the log or something like that. I can't remember the exact details, but it's when you think about it, it's super obvious. But I'm just in game mode and I'm just like, oh, there's a loot container. Inside it is a story item, process story item. And I just like listen to it and it just kind of
receive story points.
Like I do hear it. It's not like I'm not listening to the audio log. I'm just not connecting it to anything else. I don't think about, oh, what these things he's talking about in the audio log, where are they in the game world? Because I assume they won't be there. I assume like the story world, particularly in Bioshock. I think Bioshock has a weird case of like the past story that you're studying, all of these characters and events and story things that happened before the fall of Rapture feel so far removed from the ecosystem thing that you're actually exploring as a player, where there's little sisters and there's big daddies and splicers, and the splicers attack the big daddies trying to get to the little sisters, and that's a sort of like an ecological thing and like a game system, and it's so pure violence and madness, and it's so animal and has nothing to do with, you know, the music that's playing and the architecture that these people apparently built before they all went completely nuts.
I have the opposite in that I find this quite easy to maintain, but I think he actually hit on something, or made me think about it differently, in that when he said that, is it easy when playing for an audience? Because I role play games to myself. Like, I will restart a game if I don't feel like I've attached to the environment sufficiently. Like, and it's really super hard to describe, but like if I find myself coasting or in game mode, I stop. And then I do it again. Like, that's why I've restarted Fallout 4 three times. Because I had to click, like, the character and the environment and everything else. I think that game has some problems with that particular start. But, like, if it's not clicking and I'm not finding it easy to tell myself the story, then I don't get as much out of it. And that's what I enjoy about those kinds of games is essentially using all of the different environmental things that the developers laid out in order to tell myself the story. Which I don't think is necessarily, you know, the best way to play or the only way to play something. It's just that it's how I've always played RPGs. Like, I've always wanted to paper over the cracks because I want to have that immersive experience. So I kind of will use my imagination to fill in when the game isn't, and some games obviously resist that, right? But I'll use my imagination to fill in and stuff. And, but it's, I think, yeah, it's because it's become at that point a performance that I'm putting on for myself, basically. I'm performing the role of the character in a way that fits the world so that I, in some abstract way, get to enjoy a story with more integrity. Like, I don't feel like I can just be myself, quote unquote, as a player because I don't want to be a player. I want to be the guy in the game experiencing things as they would experience it.
Yeah, I always struggle with this because I love it when I slip into that kind of state, but I often find the artificial ways that, you know, environmental storytelling, like the artificial mechanisms by which that's done, take me out of it completely. So audio diaries now are just dead to me as a kind of immersive thing. Like I when I first started listening to them, and, you know, it's such a thing now that when I pick up an audio diary, it takes me, I realize I'm playing a game because it's just people repeating the same tropes over and over again, the same ways to tell the story. And if someone's scrawled a message on a wall in blood, it's not that I can connect all the dots and see what they're trying to do, but I'm seeing the construction. I'm not seeing the world that they're actually trying to communicate, because I think we just need more inventive methods of environmental storytelling than just literally writing messages on walls.
Yeah.
Soma's audio diary conceit was that there are these kind of communication points and they had a buffer in them. And so the last person to use it to talk to someone, it would sort of have a replay of their, of the conversation they had. And so that was like audio diaries plus, because you had two people talking. The problem with it was that I used one of these and it started a conversation. And then I was listening to the conversation, you know, carried on my way, continuing to play the game. But the conversation just stops if you walk away from the thing. So you just have to stand there,
Yeah, it's really annoying.
Listening to it and doing nothing else. And actually, weirdly, I think I engage... Well, if I can listen to an audio diary and continue to roam around and just explore and do stuff, I'm engaging more with that audio diary than I am if you ask me to stay still. Because if you ask me to stay still, I just won't listen to it. I'll just walk away. That's just... You might as well have not added that to the game at all.
It's interesting. This is something I think actually Fallout 4 does well in a different sense, in that it has, and I've realized, because I do the same thing, I think, and I don't like that audio diaries as a storytelling mechanism because they very rarely make any sense as things that would happen.
Yeah.
Like, in Fallout, like in the, you go into like a facility or a vault or something, a lot of the computer terminals will have the same files on them. And they won't actually be very useful. Like, occasionally you'll dig out the location of where a safe might be from someone's sort of incidental emails or something. But there's a gaminess to a lot of this stuff where, like, every email is important, or, like, you have to read everything because everything is significant and unique to that terminal that you found it on. Deus Ex, I'm somewhere in the middle on this, but generally you do want to see everything. Whereas in Fallout, it feels safer to bypass stuff because, logically, not every computer system is going to be interesting. So you don't feel as much pressure to kind of, you know, and also, like, the same is true of the audio diaries in Fallout. Like, there's a vault where, without spoiling anything, you find basically a big cache of tapes of job interviews at the end. And those job interviews kind of tell you something about what the nature of the social experiment in that vault was. It makes sense that they would tape record the job interviews and that there would be a stack of them on somebody's desk. And they're all the same conceit. Like, each tape is the same process being undergone with different people, but you don't have to listen to all of them. It's quite a big ask to listen to all of them, because you pick them like three audio, because my first instance was like, fuck, three audio diaries at once, you maniacs, I'm gonna sit in this room like
it can't
minutes.
Be done.
Yeah, but then I realized, hang on, I can listen to one of these and piece it together the information I got from a terminal earlier, and I feel like I know enough about this story that I don't have to listen to the other two, or like I can later or something.
Yeah, you could. They're sort of just tapes that you carry around with you, and you can kind of plug them into your
Pip-Boy.
Weirdly, you can also plug them into any computer you find, seemingly.
Yeah, like, well, they're just discs, right? It's like a CD-ROM, right?
Like, I'm not surprised that's physically possible, but it's just surprised that they added it as a sort of game mechanic.
There's lots of that in that game, actually. Like, there's lots of little incidental things. It's just like, just because you should be able to, which is nice.
Like, it's interesting playing Metal Gear Solid 5, where which is like audio diary heaven or hell, depending on your
God.
With the like, entire
its
plot
best feature is that it marks in gold the ones you really should you won't understand anything.
Yeah. The interesting thing about MGS5 is that it gives you kind of moments of downtime. It lets you play it as you're doing missions, of course, but listening to, you know, your pals talk about whether they should wash D-Dog or not, or while you're trying to infiltrate a base, just doesn't really make any sense. But I have sat on the helicopter and listened to audio diaries, and that, I find that quite atmospheric as a place to stand still and listen to things.
There's an app that allows you to get the audio diaries on your phone, which is actually really good. Like, I listen to a lot of the audio diaries while doing the dishes.
Yeah, maybe
that kind of makes sense.
For Metal Gear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I think that doesn't work for PC.
Oh, shit.
I tried to get it, and it said it was only for PS3 and... I think the Fallout 4 Pip-Boy does work for PC though. I don't know if you can listen to audio diaries on it, but it's basically, you know, it's your Pip-Boy functions.
Yeah,
I installed it and it works and it's nicely made, but the only problem with it is that if you bring up the menu in game, it pauses the game. If you look at it on your phone, it doesn't pause the game. So it's better to bring it up on your main computer. Like, using it on your phone is a disadvantage because then you got to worry about being attacked while you're doing it.
But that's more immersive when you're wearing your plastic Pip-Boy.
Yeah.
Because that's what it'd be really like in real life, where you wear a computer in your wrist, which is officially the worst place to put a computer. CCB writes... No, hang on. That's... No, his name is Thomas. He says, "Hey, CCB," which I imagine stands for crowbar. Well, I fucked that. Thomas. I don't know. Just listen to your last podcast. And the final question, someone asked what was something from movies that you'd think would be ripped off in later games. One thing he suggests is from the film Jupiter Ascending, which he enjoyed despite most people disliking it. Channing Tatum's character has a pair of what can I describe as air rollerblades. Basically, it allows him to rollerblade in the air, whether it be a couple of inches off the ground or 1,000 feet up. I don't think it would be a main mechanic in a game, but I could see it as a power-up or something along those lines. Which actually sounds like fun, but it also sounds a lot like a bug.
Yeah.
Here's a question. One thing I always find interesting is in some game studios, they have a person who's the top of the field, a very specific thing. Say a game studio might have a guy who only works on water or fire or trees because they're the absolute best at it. In all your time as a games journalist, have you ever met someone who's the absolute best at one very specific thing in games? You might have met people who are at the top of, say, AI design, but I guess I mean stuff that might seem a bit more insignificant or underappreciated in game design. Thanks for reading and keep up all the good work, Thomas.
I went to preview the game Velvet Assassin, which turned out to be terrible.
Yeah.
I never played it, but the verdict was pretty unanimous.
Rest assured.
But I talked to a guy there, and I said, "Oh, so what did you do before you worked here?" And he said, "Oh, I worked at IO Interactive." And I said, "Oh, man, I love Hitman Blood Money." He said, "Oh, yeah, I worked on Hitman Blood Money." And I said, "Oh, I love the art in that game." I said, "Oh, I was an artist on that game." And I said, "Oh, in particular, I really love the lighting." I said, "I was in charge of the lighting on Hitman Blood Money."
And you woke up without kidneys.
So yeah, I met the guy who did the lighting in Hitman Blood Money, and he was, I think it was a technical artist or environment artist or something, but it was his job to make it look that way. And it does have this very particular, like, each level has its own kind of lighting motif, and it kind of runs throughout all of it. And it's one of the few games where, like, each level feels really different and has a different art style almost.
Really careful kind of post-processing settings on each level in that game, which kind of changes almost the tone of every colour in the map is set to a certain kind of hue, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really awesome. I went to Reddick and I met one of their special effects guys who is exclusively responsible for their fantastic artillery effects in their RTSs. He was working on Company of Heroes 2 at the time, but I think he did Company of Heroes 1. He definitely did Dawn of War 2. And so I was just quizzing him for ages about the differences between doing like a World War II shell and an orbital laser attack, and what kind of you think about when you're trying to create those effects. And a lot of it, he talked about a lot of it was just taking influence from footage, especially with World War II, where you get to see like Earth being thrown up and displaced in these vertical kind of columns, and just recreating that in a realistic way just is instinctively effective because that's just how you understand, you know, grant the Earth to work. So when you see that actually unfold in front of you, it's a convincing explosion. But for an orbital space laser, he turned to Akira, which is an excellent move because Akira has a fucking extraordinary conception of an orbital space laser, which is, it doesn't really make any physical sense because as it's aiming, the area at which it's pointing, almost like gravity seems to reverse, or some kind of pressure is exerted on the area before the laser strikes.
Yeah.
So all these little pebbles are lifted up, and there's this sense that some sort of, you know, titanic force is about to be unleashed. So, gravity itself is inverting, and then the laser strikes, and it's this massive, horrendous explosion.
Fuck, that's good.
Yeah, which is amazing. And he channeled that into the Space Marine.
That
Dawn of War 2.
That's been in everything. This idea that things lift off the ground just before a massive space laser hits it.
Yeah. Like physics we've invented.
But there's, I don't know. It's kind of it's so effective.
Mm.
Yeah.
When I was at BlizzCon, actually, I met the guy because they had Overwatch developers looking after the press area where you could play Overwatch. I met a guy who does. He's a 3D artist, I think a concept artist on the game. But he was telling me kind of what he'd made, and I pieced it together, and he basically made all of the devices in that game. Mm. I think the only character he fully designed was Reinhardt, who is a man in a huge suit of armor.
Oh, yeah.
But also, D.Va's mech and Zarya's gun and that kind of thing. And there's so many, really rad, actually talking about anime, really rad sort of, classic anime, Battleship Yamato derived, tech in it, sort of I don't know exactly how you describe that. Mm. It's not bolts and metal, it's smooth plastic and kind of industrial panels. Design and panels, loads of fucking panels. Man has made a lot of panels.
Mm.
And that's kind of cool that the way the way it folds and moves and those kind of devices behave. Is kind of one guy, apparently, which is kind of cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, Tony gives us a challenge. He says, Dear Geclea Bosca Agus Gro, which is Crane Crowbar in Irish, apparently.
Oh, wow.
And I've almost certainly fucked that up. After listening to episode 119, where you pronounce traditional MMORPGs deadly dead 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 dead, I was wondering where you see people getting a future multiplayer PvE, that being player versus environment, so fighting monsters, fix from. Over the years, I've enjoyed raiding in WoW and Tor, and I like the notion of a team working together for a set goal. With the rise of MOBAs and so on, it seems this is receding in popularity as people switch exclusively to PvP. What do you think the options beyond WoW will be for somebody who wants to kill a big internet monster with 10 to 20 other people? Keep up the great work. Thanks, Tony.
Well, the real answer is Destiny, sadly, because we're a PC gaming podcast. But that is the modern idea. But also Diablo 3.
But basically Diablo, because Destiny takes a lot from Diablo. And
yes.
I think it's more that... I think, essentially, those big persistent worlds became about repeated experiences within those big persistent worlds.
Mm.
And games like Diablo just simply do repeated experiences better because, you're not faffing between dungeon runs and stuff. It's much more efficient and slick with how it uses your time.
There's a much greater focus on the how satisfying skills are to execute, how satisfying it is to punch things, definitely. Just that's where it's at, really. Doing that with friends is fun.
Vanilla Nougat writes, Dearest Cream and Cobbler, I've recently been replaying the original Fear, and after what feels like, and likely has been, absolutely ages, it holds up surprisingly well, but besides that, I've noticed something rather interesting. For whatever reason, I'd completely expunged any memory of the hilarious Alienware registered trademark product placement in the game. Every single recently deceased office peon and constructor in this world was apparently a totally deadly elite gamer with lots of disposable income. Are there any other instances of product placement in games? I think there might have been Duracell batteries in Pikmin, but beside that, nothing else comes to mind. Thanks for reading, everybody. Vanilla Nougat.
Graham is the expert on this, but he couldn't make it tonight, so I'm going to step into his place and talk about Zool.
The ninja from the Nth Dimension.
The Nth Dimension.
And also Chupa Chups.
Funded by Chupa Chups. So levels were literally just you'd be jumping on and over Chupa Chup, giant Chupa Chup lollies to kill enemies and things like that.
Was this game conceived as a marketing effort for Chupa Chups?
No, not really. It doesn't come across that way.
It was his own thing.
It's
and
really
then,
weird, yeah.
Did they decide to make a platform about candy and then...
Seemed like an opportunistic deal then happened.
The thing is, it's not really about candy because he's a ninja from the Nth Dimension.
But it's like all the levels are sort of made of candy, right, aren't they?
Well, no, it's weird. Sometimes you just come across a patch of Chupa Chup trees and then this is branded as fuck. There's branding everywhere. It's really strange. It's really strange, but it's not alone in that era. There were the... not the M&M, was it M&M's?
There was an M&M's platformer. M&M's, yes, there was. Platformers. Because you can make a platformer out of anything, really. You just needed a colourful character and then platforms.
So there are obviously a lot of companies, marketing departments, who want to take advantage of this. No, you literally played as M&M's jumping around the world, didn't you?
The other one that springs to mind for me is The Matrix Online, which was a super interesting game that didn't really do everything it should have done. But it was obviously, like, as talking about MMOs, the perfect high concept for an MMO, right? You don't actually get any better as an idea for an MMO than the fucking Matrix, right? Especially as a franchise, big franchise MMO. And the way it worked is, you know, I used to love the intro to sequence of that game. After you made your character, and this felt mega from the future at the time, it cut to, like, somebody on one of those ships from the Matrix, like, scanning in the Matrix for somebody to pull out the Matrix like they do to Neo at the start. And it's just like a shot of a big civilian street, and then your character that you've just made walks around the corner. And you inexplicably look cool on everybody else because you've decked yourself out in designer clothes, like real designer clothes. Like, if I remember right, like, most of the clothes in that game were real in some way. And obviously, The Matrix has a huge fashion component to it and how people dress, the leather jackets and stuff. So basically, you get given the red pill, which has taken on so many bad connotations since the movie's been ruined. But on account of your excellent jacket. Which you shouldn't go and buy in real life, but not so you can take the red pill, because you should never do that.
I remember Splinter Cell, was it Chaos Theory or one of the others? No, maybe the one after Chaos Theory, Double Agent, had some kind of really conspicuous product placement. Either for like a chewing gum or a bottled drink, and like the whole part of the plot is like a whole city gets its power cut, and the only thing left standing is like a Wrigley sign or something, or whatever the brand was. And I also remember, like, in Ubisoft games in general, they often have posters for their other games in the game worlds. And one thing I assumed was product placement, which wasn't, is Human Revolution, the Deus Ex game. In Pritchard's office, he has like a Final Fantasy 17 poster set in the future, and they're sort of like, he's got a jokey extrapolation that they're going to do that many Final Fantasy games. And I listened to the audio commentary recently by the developers, and apparently, not only is that not product placement, but it was a huge pain in the ass to get that cleared through Square Enix. I thought it was like Square Enix come down and said, you'd have a Final Fantasy poster in there, wouldn't that be great? But it was actually the Eidos Montreal saying, we'd like a Final Fantasy poster in that, can we do that? And then having to go up through like 19 chains of bureaucracy and talk to like the head of Square Enix had to actually personally approve it and see the final art and make sure that it was all right. And they have like a sort of visual joke in it where the number, you know, it's Roman numerals, and it goes on so long that you actually can't see what the number is. It's obscured by the art.
Just underneath that poster, Pritchard is trying to rebuild the bike from Akira.
That's what that is.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Which is not also product placement, but
is
rad. It's a really nice little kind of nod to Pritchard's character as well.
Yeah, I noticed he's rebuilding a bike. I didn't know if it was this particular one. And then he's got this arch of TV monitors, which is really visually cool. But I don't know, is that just an art installation, or is he...
It's hard to tell with Deus Ex Revolution, isn't it? Because there's so many kind of like cool things that the artist just put in, and there are a load of references to like...
When cool you take an office in that universe... You like fill out a form that describes the type of high concept light installation you'd like to have, and the manner in which you'd like it to frame you, were you to stand directly in front of it.
I'm replaying that kind of at the moment, on and off. And in Heng Sha, there's a like an entire building's worth of space that is just piled up air conditioners. Like, it's a city block, and there's flats either side of it, and there's just, like, this, instead of a building, there's just, like, 400 air conditioners piled on top of each other and kind of, like, strapped in so that they don't fall out. And I'd never noticed that before. It was like, what the fuck? And, yeah, so that game is full of junk repurposed.
That's where the vents live. That's the opposite. That's that Bioshock thing.
That's how you get in all the vents. Yeah. Out all the air conditioners.
Yeah, well, in that Bioshock game earlier, where it's people living, it's, you know, the buildings are people and the people are buildings. You climb in, you help the vent people climb in through the giant mat. I don't know.
One final product placement thing tying into Deus Ex is that in the Deus Ex Mankind Divided trailer, where you first see Jensen, he's wearing a jacket that is branded with a Japanese label, like a really kind of expensive, super kind of high level fashion Japanese.
A real world one.
Yeah, a real world one.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And, yeah, I assume that then maybe tie-in products.
Probably some money Jane fans. They did, yeah. They did tie in, you could buy Jensen's coat, right, from the store. Apparently it's not at all like his coat.
No, apparently it's rubbish. But then, if you want to have a laugh, you should, go onto Google image search and search for, Deckard's coat from Blade Runner, which you can buy. But, no human that isn't Harrison Ford can wear it without looking like a bit of a plonker. So
that's kind of true of trench coats in general, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably is. Sadly.
There's a lot of things that are,
everyone's tried it, but
it's kind of cool. Film, but yeah.
There's a lot of things that are kind of cool in character designs, but you just shouldn't wear them yourself. It just doesn't work in real life.
Finally, we have a long post from the forum. So I'll have to paraphrase some parts of it. It's a response to Tom Senior's comments about the Old Republic.
I was very mean about the Old Republic, and I made someone sad.
And we're going to read it out and you know, write a reply, so on. So this is a trial of Tom Senior. Timmy Timmins writes, I don't know why I'm writing this. You probably don't even read the episode threads. Haha! We clearly do.
We do.
Owned. I just have to wrap, because I hear people talk about so often about a game that I loved and not even recognize the game they're discussing, which is Star Wars The Old Republic. He says it was not a dated or an original MMO. It was a very well-designed improvement on the genre it was part of. I don't think it's fair to call Guild Wars the same genre. I will refer to Tor, like WoW, as a taskbar RPG, because that's what it was. The brilliance of Star Wars The Old Republic... Sorry, I'm saying Tor rather than Swtor, because Swtor is really a pain in the ass to say, is how they introduced the concept of weak and standard enemies. These enemies were in packs all pulled at the same time and had completely different rules set regarding crowd control. This allowed them to balance raiding and PvP independent of leveling while maintaining common abilities and keybinds. This resulted in a 20-ability taskbar MMO where the abilities were relevant and interesting with nuanced applications and multiple uses in leveling. There were real decisions which mode to use spells in. Do you want to ravage for maximum damage against a strong enemy or overkill a standard enemy but take advantage of the 3-second channel stun that it provided but only against standard and weak enemies? What about Force Scream? It's one of your highest DPS abilities. But do you pop it on cooldown for your DPS rotation or do you use it as a gap closer due to it being one of the only abilities that is not melee range? Similarly, standard and weak enemies made AoE relevant. They gave you a set of AoE abilities that you actually used outside of trash pulls in dungeons. Weak and standard enemies accomplished an important thing, which is rewarding certain playstyles and builds. A consular might go fight monsters in the jungle because monsters are often alone and often quite strong. A power tech might fight gangsters because the power tech's powerful AoE favors clumps of enemies. The classes went through the zones themselves differently. He then talks about healers being easy but slow, complains that journalists insist on playing easy and slow versions of the game, which we don't insist really, but it's fine. And covers his experience with the game in more detail. Sorry, I can't read the whole thing, but it is, super long. He concludes, that it was a great taskbar MMO. While I'm fine with you not liking taskbar MMOs, it makes me sad to see people pretend it didn't exist and was just a single player RPG in some empty rooms. I didn't even recognize the game you talked about and it made me sad.
Well, with regards to the single player with empty rooms attached, I'm talking about what Tor is now.
Yeah, which is an important thing to point out.
Substantially, like, they've redesigned it to the extent that, like, you talk about healers, you know, my first companion as a consular is a healer. He's a big giant lizard dinosaur man that heals me all the time. And he heals me continuously, with more healing effect than damage I could possibly take. So that removes combat from the game entirely. It's just combat is just not part of that game for me anymore. And I'm enjoying it because I'm really enjoying the story and stuff. But I feel like a lot of that kind of nuance and stuff that was perhaps present in the game 3 years ago, it's definitely been probably eradicated now as part of the redesign. But I did play it 3 years ago, actually. And I think maybe I lost out on a lot of this nuance because I didn't go raiding and doing a lot of the kind of really advanced stuff. But I did take my Sith Warrior to level 50 with basically 6 abilities on rotation that dealt with every trash mob. And for a 20 skill taskbar MMO, there's some redundancy there, surely, if that's the case.
So, because I can see both sides of this, because I think it's super weird having this conversation about a different Star Wars MMO that's changed dramatically and broken the heart of people who loved it how it was. So I feel you, man. I really do. But... I played Imperial Agent as a healer, which I actually found interesting. Like, I think some part of this actually comes back partly to that efficiency question. The thing I really agree with this comment about is that taskbar MMOs are a super specific thing and that maybe that gets forgotten sometimes. Like, I think I've always hated it when people just refer to, oh, it's just an MMO. Because while it's often possible to play these games with like an inefficient rotation that will honestly get you through the game, part of the fun, I think, is figuring out how far you can push efficiency. Which, you know, there are things you can complain about that. Like, if the fun thing is getting through the game faster, then that's ultimately a grind and so on. But I do agree that, like, it's fun to figure out that, oh, there's a way I can progress through each of these zones, that I can just tweak little things about my character and my companions and the exact rotation I'm using and how I'm using my buffs and my other things and how I use stealth as an Imperial agent for so on, how I time that with stuns and other disables and nukes and so on. To, I don't know, make the machine work faster or better. It's an engineering challenge, I think, weirdly, that people, and people often don't appreciate that about these types of games. And actually, I would agree with him completely that at release, The Old Republic was a very, very good example of that. Like, I raided, but I think even before then, I was enjoying it to the end, because even when going through another zone, and that game suffered, I think, for having repetitive zone structure, you would settle into a kind of almost meditative state of operating this complex machine that, and, you know, you could do it with just a couple of abilities. Like, I think maybe that's my response to the I got through the game with six abilities thing, is I know, I can think of times where I'd be like functioning super well and using all of my abilities and like getting it mega clean, like just doing this really clean, like finesse run. But then sometimes I'd just be like, oh, I'm tired. 1-3, 1-3, 2-2, 1-3 and so on.
Yeah. The game, like the game is selling a fan, like this fantasy of being a hero in a Star Wars universe. It's not selling this fantasy of, you know, take these really esoteric and complex systems and then maximize them. So it's this, it's hard to blame people for just doing what works and then just kind of getting from point to point. But I think both approaches are totally valid, and I can completely understand why it'd be really frustrating for someone who's really, really into the systems to hear someone who's just kind of blasted through it. But both are equally valid approaches to that game. And one of them is boring and one of them is interesting.
Yeah, and the boring one is actually the path of least resistance, which is a mistake a lot of games will fall into.
What would you guys say are the best stories class-wise in that game?
Imperial Agent.
Yeah, I mean, I've not played Imperial Agent, but it sounds fucking great.
So actually, two I'd recommend. So if you want the actual sequel, if you want KOTOR 3, play Jedi Knight. Because that is actually built, it pretty much is a more direct sequel to the themes and stuff from the Knights of the Republic games.
I haven't. I've played a bit of KOTOR 1, but...
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. So, but if you're coming to it, I think I would suggest you played Agent, because it's... And I think I must have spoken about this podcast more than once, but I really want to go back to Tor, actually. I just have a time, like I'm playing Fallout and stuff.
Yeah.
But the Agent storyline is, I think, the best evidence for why they should have made that game, because Tor is absurd.
That's actually what I played at the preview event that I went to, and I really liked it, and I was intrigued by the story. And I was playing, I can't remember if it was by choice or not, but I was playing the male character, and it's one of the very few male protagonist voices
I really like the agent voice. It's an acquired taste, because it's a very clipped British accent. Yeah. Like, they got the Imperial thing kind of down. That guy actually plays a banker in one episode of Sherlock in the first season. like the banker that hires them because his bank's been like scammed or something, is the Imperial agent from Tor, and I can't, that episode really, really weirded me out when I heard it, because I'd listened to that voice for like 300 hours. Yeah, he's great. Most of the voice acting is good, but he's the one that most stands out as really different to other things. But the story is, brilliant as well. Like, it's the reason I said that it justifies the game, not because the rest of them are bad, but because if they'd made one RPG, one single player game, that's the story they would never have made. Like, they might have made the one where you play a Republic trooper or a cool bounty hunter or a Sith warrior or a Jedi Knight, but they'd never make the one about the guy who works for the government and has to clean up after these assholes. Like, and you are a cool spy. Like, the fantasy is you're a cool spy, and you can do that in, like, you can be, you know, Star Wars Jason Bourne about things. You can be Star Wars James Bond about things. You can side with the Sith and so on, but it has some genuinely really good, really good stuff in it, and some genuinely like tense choices. Like, it does something that I've really like it's not, because in terms of big BioWare decisions, most of them come down to like a big moral choice and you're absolutely in control, whereas the thing I love so much about that story is it tells a Star Wars story where you're not really the most public of figures, and you're not even the person with the most of the power. Like, if you're as an agent in the Sith Empire who doesn't have the Force, you are basically, you could be killed by your superiors at any time. Like, they've built a story around the concept that Darth Vader chokes a lot of his subordinates. So if you imagine being one of those subordinates and trying to steer the direction of that system of government, which is dumb, and you can play a character who knows that this system of government is fucking stupid, and the amount of different directions. It also has, I think, the most diverse set of endings of any of the others, in terms of like where you can end up as a character, although that has some, a complicated relationship with future DLC. But yeah.
I was also tempted by the Republic Trooper?
Yeah.
Sort of soldier. The female version of that is Jennifer Hale. So. Yeah.
That's Commander Shepard's big Star Wars war story.
So. That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff. I think if there's anything to be said for the way they streamlined the game, if it allows you to, cause basically the way the game's structured is completely formulaic in that, and on a given, you progress through the story as linear progression of planets, basically. And on each planet, you will have a story that's unique to your character, and ultimately, which will be partly self-contained, but then, like a season of a TV show, ultimately part of your character's overall arc, in part of three major acts. But then on each planet, you also have the story of the planet, which will be specific to your faction, but not so what the Empire is doing on that world. And then within that, you'll have lots of side stories as well. And I did absolutely everything. And if you do absolutely everything, there's shitloads of good stuff in that game, but there's also a lot of filler.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just did the class stories, I think that's what gives you the kind of the BioWare arc through the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm after.
Yeah, that definitely works. Like, I've been replaying it recently with Jedi Consular, and I couldn't get on with Jedi Knight. I just had to drop that storyline because there's just absolutely no room for you to express anything other than total devotion to the Force, which makes sense because it's the Jedi, right? Which is the first character I took up to 50 was Sith Warrior, because when you're in the Sith, you just get, you have more freedom of expression with what you're allowed to say to people.
Sorry, that's just an amazing sentence. When you're with the Sith, you just have more freedom of expression.
Well, they're all about their feelings. Like, yeah, I mean, it is actually really good Star Wars fiction. Like, you get all the different elements of it.
It's really, really great. And the Sith Warrior thing is, you know, you end up with your thralls and that kind of thing, and you get to see them develop, and knowing how the Sith thing works, you know that one day they will try and probably kill you, and that's not a spoiler or anything. It's just a thing you know about the Star Wars universe that applies to your interactions with them that makes it very interesting.
This feels like a BBC documentary about like 50 years after this war, interviewing one of the people who was on the bad side. Like, why did you go with the Sith? Why did you have so much freedom of expression?
It would be really funny. We must tell a story in the pod before, but like, because you, me, and Tom Hatfield played through a lot of Tor at roughly the same time, and we would like meet up. Almost like the characters were meeting up and talk about what we'd each been doing in the gaps between doing like essentially like the group missions together. And it would be like, you would have been like overthrowing another fucking Sith Lord on your rise to power.
So many.
I would have been like trying to very subtly prevent a war without looking like I was preventing a war, because the Sith really wanted to go to war, but they can't afford it. So they need me to discreetly prevent the war from happening, but they can still have their feelings.
Yes.
They can still be mega angry, but nothing happens. Yeah. And like, and Tom was, who was playing a Sith Inquisitor, would have eaten a ghost.
Like, he had the maddest story. Yeah.
He would have spent an entire planet preparing and eating a goat.
The really great thing about Tor is that it lets you into some of those story missions as well, and so you can kind of
tag along on each other's
tag
story.
Along while Tom went to eat a ghost, he would just go through all his single player conversations, but we'd be studying the background, focus, just kind of there watching him do
like being each other's companions is kind of super cool as well.
It's
like,
really,
and when
really
it lets
good.
You. Like, when it lets you talk over each other as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's when, or like, the, I mean, it, using a dice roll to determine who gets to make the decision is dumb.
It's still really fun, though.
But it almost weirdly works, because it feels a bit like real conversation sometimes. Like, you're the first person to speak up.
Yeah, I happen to say something.
But you get the moral alignment points of the decision you chose, not what happened. So if Tom Hatfield goes, I think we will butcher the orphans, please. But I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, in the background, you just see me get loads of light side points. Like, I didn't want to do this.
I feel good about objecting to what we are actually going to do.
But then the next cutscene, just gunning them down.
That stuff worked brilliantly.
Not the younglings.
Also, the Tor equivalent of dungeons, fantastic.
Flashpoints.
The flashpoints. And now they're more really accessible with the way they've redesigned it. Is that you can solo them if you want to.
At my preview event thing, they were just brutal. We just got wiped six times.
They were supposed to be like proper dungeons in the old school kind of taskbar MMORPG sense. But now, if you want to go and do them solo, because the stories are really good. They're really good, kind of, you're on a starship and it's going to blow, and are you going to stop it? You know, are you going to, who are you going to sacrifice to make it?
It's funny, I'd still recommend playing it with somebody, because that's what's special about it, is that moment where you feel like a party of adventurers that, like, because we played it at the same, I think, you know, and that's one of the reasons I haven't gone back, is because it lost that momentum where it was like, we were all playing, and then we'd meet up again, and it helped that we lived together, so we could meet up again to do a flashpoint relatively easily. And then, you know, you actually feel like, you know, it felt like, in my canon version of that game that's in my brain, because again, of how I play games, like, my agent was off basically systematically undermining the Sith most of the time. But he had to, like, two all right Sith mates that he would, like, frequently meet up with. Or, like, but because, like, I created a guy who had, like, these, like, because he was a cyborg, like, had these, like, but the only cybernetics that showed was this pair of, like, perfectly round, like, John Lennon glasses. And it made him impossible to read, and it looked perfect, because it was, like, he'd be sat there with, like, kind of otherwise in a kind of imperial uniform with a gun, but, like, completely unreadable because of these sunglasses, stood at the back of these two bickering Sith Lords that'd be, like, slaughtering people. And it looked completely right.
It was,
like,
so good, It worked perfectly, it really did. I love the BioWare side of that game, I really, really do. And even if I never kind of gelled with the technical systemic aspect of it, I think there's still so much good stuff in the storyline and in the stories they told.
I hope we've now made Timmy Timmons feel better by just doing nothing but praising that game for about 10 minutes.
I think I came down quite hard on it because I was comparing it to Guild Wars 2 and a lot of the things that Guild Wars 2 has done to evolve even the idea of the taskbar. And how the taskbar is a thing that you can press tilde to change into. But yeah, that's a discussion for another time, probably.
Yeah, Guild Wars 2 is brilliant mechanically. Like,
I just think it's looked at that and it's gone, how do we actually make this really interesting for everyone? And
That's something that comes up a bunch. Like, even when a designer comes back to a system and goes, actually, the system has real problems, we're going to fix it. People still like the old system. And
It's because, like, the old system was still fun to an extent. It's just
And people had shaped themselves to it as well.
Yeah, of course.
Like, and so anything else feels like a reduction. I think that's where a lot of people moaning about games becoming casual come from. It's when someone's actually intelligently gone, you don't need to do this. Like, this is bullshit. This isn't fun. But people are like, but I like the bullshit thing. I've accustomed to it in a way that makes it not bullshit to me.
Or I think it's almost that I've mastered it. I've understood and I know. I understand the contrivances of it.
And that is all the proof that we read the forums that I've got time for. If you would like to send us a question, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum, where we'll see it, apparently. You can tweet us at creightoncrowbar. You can and should also discuss the episode on our Discord channel, which is a web app or a standalone app that uses voice and text chat and stuff. It's free, and you can join the channel by finding the link on the sidebar of the main page of the website, basically bottom right. That's where most of our community are and where they talk about things and arrange games and things. That's cool. If you would like to follow us on Twitter as individuals, I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I'm at PCG Ludo, and that's LUDO.
I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
Thanks a little.